Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to the program that helps you improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We come to you every day on the radio and in a podcast to tell you about interesting and important events that are happening around the world. We usually have something for everyone. It may be about science news or the latest medicine to fight HIV/AIDS. Sometimes the stories are about important news items that are happening right now. That's how we will start today's program. We travel first to Africa to hear more about the fight against Boko Haram. The terrorists have been crossing the border from Nigeria into Cameroon to steal food for their fighters. Jill Robbins says it is a dangerous situation for farmers who refuse to cooperate with Boko Haram.
On Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, reports say Boko Haram fighters have been stealing food and animals from farmers for the past few weeks. Most of the food producers are now moving to safer areas away from the border. Mijiyawa Bakari is governor of the far north region. He said the armed men carry out raids in small groups. He said they steal cows, food, and money from Cameroonians living along the border with Nigeria's Borno state. Mr. Bakari said the border between Cameroon and Nigeria is long, and there are few border guards. He said this makes it easy for the militants to attack crop farmers, cattle farmers, and small businesses. They can quickly cross back into Nigeria after an attack. Sally Dairu is a member of the National Assembly from northern Cameroon. He told VOA that the militants have killed some of the farmers who refused to cooperate with them. There have been fewer major Boko Haram attacks in Cameroon during the last 2 months. The governor said the decrease suggests that the group has problems. Mr. Bakari said he thinks the new coalition military force of troops from Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria may be weakening Boko Haram. Mr. Bakari said he is very sure that this force will stop Boko Haram soon. He said he believes everyone can see that the end of the militant group is near. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA, the voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The new United States Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, is on a week-long trip to the Asia-Pacific area. He aims to support allies Japan and Korea while restating the U.S. commitment to the so-called Asia-Pacific rebalance. It is a complicated issue, and Katie Weaver joins us to help us understand.
That policy seeks to place more political and military power to a fast-growing area. The U.S. and China are competing for influence among Asian nations. But Ashton Carter says that does not mean they are enemies.
U.S. and China are not allies, but we don't have to be adversaries.
Sheila Smith is the writer of the new book, Intimate Rivals, Japan's Domestic Politics in a Rising China. She says the Japanese and U.S. governments are seeking new guidelines on defense cooperation. She says Japan will want to center those guidelines on China's increased power. But she says the U.S. also has been watching China as it demonstrates its growing military power. She notes that the U.S. has 50,000 American troops on the ground in Japan. Tensions between Japan and China have grown as the two argue over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Tensions over issues from World War II have also affected relations between the countries in recent years. Defense officials say the new U.S.-Japan defense guidelines will include cooperation on space and cybersecurity. Writer Sheila Smith says the guidelines work well with the Japanese government's proposed new understanding of the country's constitution. That document has historically been understood as a rejection of the use of Japanese military action, except in direct defense of the country.
And that had been extended, had been interpreted to say we can't even use force to help the United States as it's helping us.
The new understanding would approve of collective self-defense. This would permit Japan to act in alliance with the U.S. in the Pacific. But wider military possibilities for Japan could raise concern for another U.S. ally, South Korea. Ms. Smith says she believes Secretary Carter will make clear that the U.S.-Japan alliance is about the defense of Japan and will not interfere with the Korean Peninsula. Mr. Carter gave a speech before he left for the Asia trip. He spoke to students at the University of Arizona about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement with 11 other nations. Most of those nations are in Asia. Secretary Carter called on Congress to pass a law that would permit President Obama to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He said the Asia-Pacific will help define America's future. He noted that by 2050, the Asia-Pacific area will hold half of the world's people. He said in just 15 years, more than half the global middle-class population will live there. And he said regional defense spending is on the rise. Mr. Carter told the students that guaranteeing peace, economic health, and progress in the Asia-Pacific area will be their generation's central goal. Secretary Carter said the trade agreement will help increase U.S. exports by a predicted $123 billion in the next 10 years. He said it would be risky to not join the TPP. He said the U.S. could be denied access to the growing markets in the area. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. If you are new to this Learning English program, you may have noticed that we speak a little more slowly than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. If you will listen to us every day, and then practice saying the words the way we do, you will soon be speaking English the American way. So thank you for listening. Please come back tomorrow, and we'll do it again.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
America continues to lead the world as a destination for international students. But a growing number of Asian students are looking to an English-speaking country much closer to home, the Philippines. The country's low prices, open culture, and quality schools are attracting record numbers of foreign students. Koreans are leading the way, according to Jose L. Cusia, the Philippine ambassador to the United States.
There are more and more Koreans that are studying English in the Philippines. In 2004, there were about 5,700. The following year, it tripled to about 17,000. In 2012, it was about 24,000. So we're seeing an increasing number of Koreans. But they're also from other countries, Libya, Brazil, Russia.
The Philippines is in a unique position to benefit from the global demand for English education. American colonialism brought the English language here in the early 20th century. Although it is not the native language of most Filipinos, English is an official language here. More than 60 years after independence, Filipinos still speak English with a strong American accent. Today, the Philippines markets itself as the world's third-largest English-speaking country.
The truth is we actually have more people who speak English in the Philippines than the national language.
There are hundreds of private and public schools in the Philippines that teach English or teach in English. As in the U.S., schools in the Philippines range from world-class to low-quality diploma mills. Pearl Gaborno Ilustre is the chief academic officer at the TESOL Training Corporation in Manila. She says foreign students should choose their schools carefully. She recommends programs that use a modern teaching style.
One doesn't really learn language by studying grammar. We learn language by actually using it. Skills taught in the classroom or concepts taught in the classroom should have concrete goals or outcomes, outputs from the students.
Can the Philippines offer the same quality of education as the United States? Ms. Gaborno Ilustre says that is a difficult question.
Academically, we can teach English well. But in terms of usage, it's still different when a native speaker is the one teaching. But we're not far behind.
Shota Furue is a Japanese student who has studied English in the U.S. and the Philippines. He says the U.S. is better for advanced learners, but he recommends the Philippines for beginners.
They speak English as a second language. When they are tired, they learn English, and they know the difficulty of speaking English.
Visitors may come here for the low costs and white sand beaches, but they stay for the people. Almost anyone can feel at home in the Philippines, with its unique blend of Asian, Spanish, and American cultures. Ambassador Cusia agrees that Filipino people are part of the attraction.
When it comes to welcoming people, the Filipinos are unmatched.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1920s are remembered as a quiet period in American foreign policy. The nation was at peace. Americans elected 3 Republican presidents in a row: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. These conservatives in the White House were generally more interested in economic growth at home than in relations with other countries. But the United States had become a world power. It was tied to other countries by trade, politics, and shared interests. And America had gained new economic strength. This week in our series, Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith discuss American foreign policy during the 1920s.
Before World War I, foreigners invested more money in the United States than Americans invested in other countries, about $3 billion more. The war changed this. By 1919, Americans had almost $3 billion more invested in other countries than foreign citizens had invested in the United States. American foreign investments continued to increase greatly during the 1920s. Increased foreign investment was not the only sign of growing American economic power. By the end of World War I, the United States produced more goods and services than any other nation, both in total and per person. Americans had more steel, food, cloth, and coal than even the richest foreign nations. By 1920, the United States' national income was greater than the combined incomes of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, and 17 smaller countries. Quite simply, the United States had become the world's greatest economic power.
America's economic strength influenced its policies toward Europe during the 1920s. In fact, one of the most important issues of this period was the economic aid the United States had provided European nations during World War I. Americans lent the Allied countries $7 billion during the war. Shortly after the war, they lent another $3 billion. The Allies borrowed most of the money for military equipment and food and other needs of their people. The Allied nations suffered far greater losses of property and population than the United States during the war. And when peace came, they called on the United States to cancel the loans America had made. France, Britain, and the other Allied nations said the United States should not expect them to repay the loans.
The United States refused to cancel the debts. President Coolidge spoke for most Americans when he said simply, "They borrowed the money." He believed the European powers should pay back the war loans, even though their economies had suffered terribly during the fighting. However, the European nations had little money to pay their loans. France tried to get the money by demanding payments from Germany for having started the war. When Germany was unable to pay, France and Belgium occupied Germany's Ruhr Valley. As a result, German miners in the area reduced coal production. And France and Germany move toward an economic crisis and possible new armed conflict.
An international group intervened and negotiated a settlement to the crisis. The group provided a system to save Germany's currency and protect international debts. American bankers agreed to lend money to Germany to pay its war debts to the Allies. And the Allies used the money to pay their debts to the United States.
Some Americans with international interests criticized President Coolidge and other conservative leaders for not reducing or canceling Europe's debts. They said the debts and the new payment plan put foolish pressure on the weak European economies. They said this made the German currency especially weak, and they warned that a weak economy would lead to serious social problems in Germany and other countries. However, most Americans did not understand the serious effect that international economic policies could have on the future of world peace. They believed that it was wrong for the Europeans, or anyone, to borrow money and then refuse to pay it back.
Many Americans of the 1920s also failed to recognize that a strong national military force would become increasingly important in the coming years. President Coolidge requested very limited military spending from the Congress, and many conservative military leaders refused to spend much money on such new kinds of equipment as submarines and airplanes. Some Americans did understand that the United States was now a world power and needed a strong and modern fighting force. One general, Billy Mitchell, publicly criticized the military leadership for not building new weapons. But most Americans were not interested. Many Americans continued to oppose arms spending until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941.
American policy toward the League of Nations did not change much in the 1920s. In 1919, the Senate denied President Wilson's plea for the United States to join the new League of Nations. The United States, however, became involved unofficially in a number of League activities, but it continued to refuse to become a full member. And in 1930, the Senate rejected a proposal for the United States to join the World Court. The United States also continued in the 1920s to refuse to recognize the communist government in Moscow. However, trade between the Soviet Union and the United States increased greatly during this period. And such large American companies as General Electric, DuPont, and RCA provided technical assistance to the new Soviet government.
The Coolidge administration was involved actively in events in Latin America. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes helped several Latin American countries to settle border disputes peacefully. In Central America, President Coolidge ordered American Marines into Nicaragua when President Adolfo Diaz faced a revolt from opposition groups. The United States gave its support to more conservative groups in Nicaragua, and it helped arrange a national election in 1928. American troops stayed in Nicaragua until 1933. However, American troops withdrew from the Dominican Republic during this period. And Secretary of State Hughes worked to give new life to the Pan-American Union.
Relations with Mexico became worse during the 1920s. In 1925, Mexican President Plutarco Elias Calles called for laws to give Mexico more control over its minerals and natural wealth. American oil companies resisted the proposed changes. They accused Calles of communism, and some American business and church leaders called for armed American intervention. However, the American Senate voted to try to settle the conflict peacefully. And American diplomat Dwight Morrow helped negotiate a successful new agreement.
These American actions in Nicaragua and Mexico showed that the United States still felt that it had special security interests south of its border. But its peaceful settlement of the Mexican crisis and support of elections in Nicaragua showed that it was willing to deal with disputes peacefully. America's policies in Latin America during the 1920s were in some ways similar to its policies elsewhere. It was a time of change, of movement, from one period to another. Many Americans were hoping to follow the traditional foreign policies of the past. They sought to remain separate from world conflict.
The United States, however, could no longer remain apart from world events. This would become clear in the coming years. Europe would face fascism and war. The Soviet Union would grow more powerful. And Latin America would become more independent. The United States was a world power, but it was still learning in the 1920s about the leadership and responsibility that is part of such power.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. The narrators were Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith. You can find our series online with pictures, transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. ¶¶